You're listening to Real Investor Radio with Craig Feuer and Jack Bevere, where we cover advanced real estate investing topics to help you stay ahead of the curve in your real estate investing business. That's great.
Perfect.
All right. Welcome back to Real Investor Radio with Craig Feuer and Jack Bevere. We're here today. We just spent the last episode talking with Sean Mulhall from SMD Capital Group here in Maryland. Basically, if you haven't listened to the episode, we really took about a good 45 minutes to talk about how Sean went from working a W-2 job to very rapidly acquiring over 150 properties in Maryland and all of the growing pains that came along with that. And Jack and I now want to just sort of dive into where Sean is today with his partners in the business and frankly, all of the businesses that they run. So Sean, great to have you back. Welcome back to Real Investor Radio.
Thanks for having me again, guys. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been a great conversation. I really encourage people to go back and listen to the prior episodes. So Jack, why don't you go ahead and start us off?
Yeah, so John brought us up to speed where he's got, he and his partner, Mike, have about 150 properties. They've kind of brought construction halfway in-house. They've got a strategic partnership where they feel they've got, you know, the field generally under control. They've got the beginnings of a property management company. They've started to in-house that aspect of it. But losing W-2 income in a building a rental portfolio phase of the business, which is kind of like, you know, a cash flow negative exercise, that's a super difficult transition to make. And Sean was just telling us about how they'd started to get a little bit of fee income from doing some outside GC work and some flipping. And I really wanted to kind of dig into that transition because that's a very difficult one. You know, but I think like the theme being that using the skills that you've made, skills that you've earned, working and building your own rental portfolio, and now taking those forward facing to the public and turning them into fee income, frankly, by necessity, right? Because you need to create some current income with the absence of that W-2. So talk to us about that. Like you mentioned there was a couple GC jobs that came in, you started doing some flips, obviously 2021, good timing from a flipping point of view, but how did that business evolve and how did you guys turn that into a consistent stream of income?
Yeah. So, you know, we didn't do much as far as the original ones, like you were alluding to there with the first jobs that we were able to get under our umbrella, just were opportunistic things that had popped up. But what it did teach us was that there was a pipeline of possible leads coming from real estate transactions in a traditional fashion for people selling homes and buying homes. So what we tapped into was the agents on our real estate team to start to incentivize them to bring us the buyers and the sellers that they were going to be interacting with on a daily basis in the retail world, for us then to be able to utilize our services to make some actual profit on the actual before and afters of buying a home or selling a home. So we didn't even go to a like marketing perspective from like direct mail or PPC or anything like that. We just looked at the infrastructure we currently had, and we found an area that we thought we could tap into that, you know, we paid them a referral fee. We gave them 10% of profits for any job that we closed, and then we would take to the finish line. So there was no guarantee, but all they were really doing was connecting either myself or Mike with the buyer or the seller, and then it was our job to close it. And so people were, you know, a lot of the agents were very, very open to that, considering that, you know, agents are up and down with income from time to time, and now they were being given an additional revenue source that really all they had to do was make an intro.
And frankly, and probably also like helping them do their core job better, right? Like, because at that time, super low days on market, multiple offer situations everywhere, have to be competitive on terms in order to even get a deal. So like you get a buyer's agent who's showing a bunch of houses. If they can say, hey, I've got a legit GC that I can vouch for that does good work and can make this house into your dream home, That's a humongous resource for the realtor just to get that core commission, much less the referral fee, right?
Not only that, but the flip side of, hey, Mr. Seller, you know, you've got grandmom's house here, and if we just added a, you know, bit of a lift to it, we could sell it for $100,000 more. So yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah, so it really worked out that's where we tapped into and had a lot of success with that. So you obviously just, and to this day, just as FYI, we still have never paid for marketing in the construction business. Not $1. So, you know, we have still really utilized that space, our retail real estate team, as our funnel. And it's really been successful for us. And, you know, obviously that can dry up at any point in time, but even in today's age of, you know, low inventory, things like that, the same thing that Craig and Jack, you were just speaking to, like, it almost allows us to still capitalize on those because we're giving that buyer or seller an extra avenue that a lot of real estate agents either don't market or don't have the ability to market. Mm-hmm. So it works out for the retail team and helps us drive more volume there. It works out for our construction team to have us drive more volume there as well.
Now, I have, we have done both, and I now consider it a tremendous luxury to only work for ourselves. Like, we're our own general contractor as well. And mm-hmm. it is a tremendous luxury to just be able to own your own mistakes and not have to go like answer, you know, like, you know, we make a mistake, we pay for it, we move on, as opposed to having to go to the client and, you know, explain the screw up. Like, both from a sales point of view and from a customer service point of view, those are not light lifts, right? No. Like, to add those aspects to the general contracting business, which is difficult enough in and of itself, like, yep. to add that for the retail facing side of things, like, talk to me about that, because I found that to be extremely difficult, and frankly, we've built a machine that doesn't do it, and I personally think it's a luxury to not have to go work for retail. But how have you guys built that out to be able to do it well?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, obviously, the situation is when you're working with somebody else compared to working for yourself, it's a whole other can of worms of what you have to be prepared for and how to handle it. You know, the big thing for us was that in the beginning, we really didn't have an option because I didn't have an option because I needed to make money. So like you kind of, even if it's a square peg round hole, you got to make it work for at least a short amount of time because I needed the revenue for me to live and for me to continue to drive the acquisitions of our properties and be able to have money to put into buying more houses, which is the overarching goal and has been for since we started this. So, you know, end of the day, we've really tried to make it a focus that we're putting prices out for what we'll do at a price that we will make enough money to deal with the stuff that comes along with it. So we're not just bidding jobs to get a job. We're bidding jobs that if we get the job, the full thing of what you just said, the full list of what you have to deal with, it's justified because the profit is X. And so for us, we've also recently, and this wasn't something historically we did, but we've recently hired a director of construction that is someone who's now taking this off of mine and Mike's plate. Historically, we were still doing it. And we were just involved in that part of it because it was something that we weren't really putting a lot of, I don't want to say we weren't putting effort towards it, but it wasn't something that was like a real big time suck from the expectations of we were doing it when they came in, and we were obviously had the feelers out there, but we weren't actively pursuing it on a daily, weekly basis. So, it, you know, it's one of those things that in general for us, the like you said, at some point in time, you know, having to be able to be your own boss when it comes to this kind of the business construction, where you're only doing what you do, would be obviously a situation that would make a lot of sense from an ease. But I think the profitability of what we were doing because of the numbers we were putting out and we were getting for our jobs, it just justified the extra effort and the extra work it would take to work for someone else.
You know, Jack, I find it's really interesting because we know rehabbers here in town and around the country, Jack, who are very good at what they do, and they team up with decent contractors, but not every contractor, Jack, can work a flip for an investor versus a retail lift for a homeowner. And I think for you to recognize that you had that contractor, your friend from Guatemala, was a really great stroke of genius on your part to see that this guy could kind of bridge both worlds, because working for a homeowner versus, you know, some flip in Baltimore City where you're just kind of, you know, where the place is empty, you know, you don't have to worry about sweeping up every day. It's a whole different beast. And so, yeah.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. You got this guy working on stuff off Poplar Grove and like C-class neighborhoods. And then you've also got him working at like, you know, $800,000 houses in Pikesville. Like, can he do both of those things? Could he do both of those things well? Did he have different sets of crews to do both of those things well? Because we got different trim carpenters, and even amongst a particular product class, we've got the high, middle, and low guy, right? And that's not even talking about doing homeowner work in an occupied house, which is like a completely different business, right? Like it's a completely different thing. Oh, yeah. How did you guys work those matchup issues?
Yeah, so I mean, for what he does and for that part of our business, they are able to go both sides of the fence. And the way that I try to think about how that's happened is I don't want to take credit for it. It's definitely him and the way he has hired, the way he's managed. You know, he has family members that work with him. He has people he's known from Guatemala that work for him. They have a really, really strong work ethic. They work Monday through Saturday every week. They don't ever, they work, take off on Sunday, but every single week they work Monday through Saturday. They don't take off for 4th of July. Like they work consistently and they are hard workers. And the way that he's hired has been something that I've looked up to, because the people that he has working for him are people who that, like I said, can go both sides of the fence and do both jobs and not complain or not have issues with it. Very respectful. And I think what we've tried to do to integrate them into our world so that they understand that when they're working with us slash for us, that it is a collective effort and we're all one big team, is we brought them into the fold with what we do as a company for events, for, you know, dinners, things like that, so that they feel like they're a part of our team and they want to do a good job because they see what they're supporting and they see that it's not just us over here. Hey, go, you know, you missed this paint spot. It's that we're trying to present a product that they can feel like have some gratification on, that they build that product and that they're helping build this business because they see who's on the other side of the business. We have the company events, which I think you do too, Jack, where we have everybody. We have our property management, we have our construction, we have our retail real estate agents. We have everybody come in, and it's all the message we try to portray is that we're one big family. One of our core values is one big family, and we're working together. We're not individually siloed, only doing that. And we see each other once a year and they don't know what's going on or why it's going on. So they've bought into the culture of the organization as well, which then I think inherently makes them want to do a better job because we take care of them. We offer them things that they wouldn't have if they were just working for, you know, Joe Blow doing a flip in, you know, in Morrell Park and like was getting paid X under the table and, you know, maybe made some money, but also just the conditions and the way that we treated them was not really necessarily what they were looking for. So I think it's a twofold approach to it, but I think that he set the bar and then I've tried to integrate in our systems, processes and just culture to make them feel like they're part of something that maybe they wouldn't necessarily feel with just a regular GC doing a, you know, $30,000 renovation in Morrell Park.
Was the income that was coming off of that part of the business now enough to sustain you and sort of, you know, get you to a point where you felt comfortable?
I'm a grinder. So I'm always in a position where I'm wanting to continue to push the envelope and continue to try to do more and so forth. So it was let me live a very comfortable lifestyle, but it was also to a point where it wasn't like I wasn't just hanging my hat and like, okay, I got this, everything's good to go. Which is kind of why while we're doing this, I also then, once I left my day job, really made the property management company a business and not just like we're going to manage our own properties, but like an active business where we're turning a profit, where we're doing a lot of, trying to buy leads, trying to incentivize people to bring us new properties, trying to work with investors and so forth so that we can build up that model. And that's kind of something that we've grown into as well, to have that as another cash flowing entity that's able for me to then take like a consistent salary out of, which is what I do. I take a salary out of the property management.
I want to dig in a lot to the property management side, mm-hmm. and you guys' approach to growing that business. Just as a reference point though, when you made the transition away from W-2, did you guys back off adding units to the rental portfolio?
Nope.
Like, did you pull that back a little bit, or was, I guess, like, how did you make that transition? And if no, then how did you make that transition how did you feel comfortable not backing that off? Or was the timing of like 2021, and like the, you know, the refi rates and, you know, liquidity was like really high at the time. Was the market strong enough from the refi side of things that helped not require you to back off?
Yeah, I mean, we did a loan with you, Jack, at Dominion, you and Fred, where we took a existing portfolio. I think we had maybe like 60 or 70 homes, and we refied it with you guys.
To took like out the banks.
To 3% with you guys. And like even with that being done, we had to pay a prepayment penalty, all this kind of stuff. But even with that being done, like that significantly changed our exposure because we were at like 7.5 and we had, you know, or maybe 7. I don't remember the exact term for it. We had the 5-year, we had balloon payment 5, whatever it was. And then we took it to the 30-year product with Dominion at like 3 and 3 and 4 something, 3.4.
Did you pull any cash out?
Even with the prepayment penalty and even with all that happening, we still, because, you know, even with the, you know, the increase in the market, we had gotten some extra cream on top that was able to come back after the refi, even though it wasn't even in existing refi for that long of time. So we had gotten some capital back from that transition into putting it with you guys. So that also happened.
Topping up to 70 or 75% LTV in 2021 when rates were, you know, 3 handles, low 4 handles, like didn't hurt that bad, right? Your payments still went down, you know, like even cashing out, your payments still went down. So coverage increased as you pulled proceeds out. Like that was just well played, sir. Well played.
Thanks. Yeah. Appreciate it. I knew a guy in Baltimore at Dominion that hooked me up. So I appreciate it.
now you know too.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks. Exactly. Thanks, Fred Lewis. That's all about now.
Fred's way too busy to talk to you.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
So talk to me about property management and growing the property management business, because that's something that we got to like 150 properties. We were using a third party. And then at 150, we were like, too uncomfortable to not have control of it. But at 150, you can afford maybe one person, but like that one person is then just stressed out doing everything. And they're also an existential threat to your, like, to you making your mortgage payments, right? Which you've got personal guarantees on. So that's a problem. So, how'd you guys think about that problem? And then what'd you do about it?
Yeah. So, when we shifted, and this was, you know, keep in mind when I hired this person before I left my W-2. So we had started to build a little bit of an infrastructure before that happened. And so I've always been in the mindset of like, I would rather spend early and get things where it needs to be than have to try to consistently chase the carrot at the, like getting more and more and more. So build it up front. So, you know, we invested in some property management software. We had, you know, brought in this person that was handling basically the ins and outs of the property management business. And then we also had this other individual's workforce at the time that was actually being more of a property manager than what she was originally hired for, and which was just like an admin. And so we had like enough of the pieces of the puzzle there. And yeah, we definitely weren't profitable right off the bat. But what we did was we started to market and we started to buy leads and we started to try to raise awareness that we were able to help investors. And just like we did with our real estate team for construction, we started to do that with the real estate team for investors and the REOs that Mike was selling to investors a lot of times. That, hey, we have a property management division. So we were tagging into the team there as well to be able to bring in good leads from people who were looking to try to get involved in the real estate, being able to have the agent then be able to talk about the construction and the property management, be a well-rounded machine where we can help you renovate it. And then after we're done renovating it, we can also manage it for you. At the same time, we were in positions where we were working with investors, and we had been doing this to a small scale where we were sourcing a property for them. We were similar to, I think, what you guys used to do back in the day, Jack, with the turnkey product. We were sourcing it for them. We were doing the construction on it, and then we're going to manage it at the end, but we never owned it. So we were just like, hey, here's this property. Here's what you can do for it. We're putting you in touch with it. They bought it. They handled all of it. And then we were making a rip off of it throughout the process. And then we were also going to have that property in our management portfolio once we were done.
So were you helping them with tenant placement as well, Sean?
Yep. We did the full 9. That's great. So then we were able to kind of build a pipeline there as well. So as that's all happening and as we're growing, we're starting to have conversations with people that are interested in being involved and having us manage, because a lot of the things was we were showcasing that we know how to help build portfolios for people because we do it. We were the real estate, we're the property manager for the real estate investor by the real estate investor. Like we were a real estate investor first and foremost, and that's how we built our property management business. Because similar to you, Jack, we had outsourced property management, we went through multiple companies, and I being a more like a tech expert kind of profile was just like, man, there's so many things that we could do better. And obviously everybody says that outside looking in, but it was like, they weren't really crazy groundbreaking things that I could do to kind of change the course of what, you know, I was lacking, I felt, from the other property managers that we were working with. So started to make some tweaks, started to market it in that light, and started to have some success bringing in some third-party management. Obviously, we were paying our property management company from our own properties as well. So then all of a sudden, we started to build a little bit and started to get some momentum. The other thing that I started to do was I started to hit the job fairs at the local colleges. So I went to the University of Maryland, I went to Towson, and I was basically obviously showcasing what we do as a whole entity and like, hey, why don't you come intern for us /, you know, be involved with our organization to see if this is what you like, because they don't teach real estate investing. They don't, people that come out of college, I came out of Maryland, and the only reason I knew about it is because my grandpa.
Wait a minute, don't they have the Ed St. John School of Real Estate there?
Yeah, exactly, right?
They're not teaching how to buy houses on Poplar.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, it was intriguing to younger, you know, usually good, sharp individuals who were in these college programs. And so we started to grab some interns. And obviously, I don't want to kick an intern, but they cheap labor. You know, you're not really paying a lot and you're getting a high quality person who is at least somewhat enough well off to be able to handle a college and a higher end institution and be able to then transition that into a role in a company. So we started to get interns in there and started to have them kind of be our boots on the ground, legwork of doing the stuff that maybe that property manager you said that was overworked couldn't do at a very, very low end rate. And what also started to happen with that was when people were graduating, they wanted to stay long. So then we were getting, once again, people who we had already technically trained because they were doing this while they were interning for us in a entry-level role at an entry-level salary, but they're coming in with experience in this space and then having them evolve with us. And as we grew, they're evolving, making more money, taking more responsibility, but we're getting them at a price point that's bearable for where we're at as an organization at the time. Mm-hmm. So a transition, we started to obviously scale up with that. That also evolved into, we now have some overseas virtual assistants that are very cost-effective and very, very strong strong team members. We do bilingual Spanish and English. So also we're able to tap into the Spanish-speaking tenant base that's out there and help to make them feel more comfortable renting from us. And we market on Spanish-speaking groups and so forth to be able to get that type of a tenant in the mix as well, which adds our bubble a little bit larger to be able to grab more people into our home. So we started to evolve into that as well. And having them, the approach we're taking with property management is we've had them support the people here in the city. So what we've really had success with is we haven't hired 10 property managers. We haven't hired all these people here. We have one property manager, we have one leasing manager. And then we have a team lead that helps out with a lot of different things, but he's not even necessarily in the property manager role. And then we have four back-end virtual assistants. And all they do is all the things that the people here in Baltimore don't have to do in Baltimore, right? Mm-hmm. So if there's anything that doesn't necessarily boots on the ground here in Baltimore, done, they do it all. They fill out, now that they have the new eviction system here with how you can file it online, they do all the eviction stuff. Obviously, the property manager has to go to court, but that's one less thing he has to do. They do all the delinquency touch bases, check-ins. They do all the back-end verifications for leasing. They do all the preparation and all the different things that, you know, when you put them in play, is very cost efficient for the amount of effort and time they're putting in. And so that keeps us with having our headcount here a little bit less from an actual personnel perspective for property management specifically, but they're not necessarily overworked. And like they do our back-end virtual assistants do our client engagement as well. So like touching base with our third-party clients, hey, how's things been? Sending out the surveys. Hey, is there anything we do to help you? And I hire very strictly on accent. So they speak very, very good English to the point of like, you might not even know that they are an overseas employee. So the client doesn't necessarily know that they're an overseas employee. They just know that somebody from our company is reaching out, which is then something that's not always happening in property management. You're developing a camaraderie that they're feeling more comfortable with you, and then we're moving it to the next level. So
go ahead, Jack.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting case study. Craig, remember that Alex Himani that
yes,
we spoke to at IMN? He's in Dallas and he has 300 and some properties, and he had one person in the US and 10 virtual assistants and ran his whole property pretty much his entire property management company virtually. So I think it's a really interesting model that seems to be becoming more and more popular. I mean, yeah, if you're not going to get in the car, right? If your job description doesn't include getting in the car, you know, why not try out a virtual assistant for that position? You can get very educated, high quality people. Speak English great, you know.
So one of the things
speak English well.
Very good.
Better than me.
Yeah. Jack, we're all still learning, Jack. One of the things that I find really intriguing is, so you're building your own portfolio, and I imagine now we're above 150 houses. They bring us up. So, you know, we're in that 2000 feels like 22, 23 time frame. The construction business is obviously growing and doing well. Now you're starting a property management business. It's growing and doing well. And this explosive growth that you're experiencing really in all three of these businesses now, with seemingly a very small staff of very competent people, man, when do the wheels start falling off? Especially, Jack, in a business of property management that I've always said was one of the most thankless businesses ever. It's just very tough. So now you're up to over 400 properties, 400 doors that you're managing. In Maryland alone, plus you've got an additional 80 to 90 doors in Eastern Pennsylvania. You know, where are you now in terms of talent and managing all of this growth?
Yeah, so we've gotten really on the property. The wheels fell off in another area of the business, but in the property management, it's still been going strong. What we've done and what I've been really aggressive about is we brought in a consultant and built a tech stack that can support to keep everybody aligned with what success looks like and what and how to hand off certain roles, responsibilities, and tasks. So we use a software called Lead Simple, but I know there's plenty of these out there, CRM software that this also has a process system structure. So what we've done is we've built in internal task management software that is so clear because the steps, when it tells you to go verify employment, it tells you the exact script to read. It tells you if they need to do a employee verification via DocuSign, how to send that out. And it's a video. And so every step of the way, we've created these stopgaps that basically allow someone to, at any point in time, in any role they're doing, make sure that they feel comfortable and confident that they're doing it correctly. So from a training perspective, everything is really tight. The other thing we did was we brought in a data analyst that works nights overseas. And they pull all the data from the prior day and send it to me in a report the morning that I come in. And then I can see if anything's out of whack, immediately address it without having to know 2 weeks later, a week later. Everything that we want to check, have checks and balances on and have a metrics on is compiled to be in a functional report the morning I come in after the day prior and has all of yesterday's data in there. We also use EOS, which I know Jack uses, and it's Entrepreneur Operating System off of Book Traction. So we use that. So we're real clear on our rocks, on accountability, on the path forward to get to the end result of what we need to do. So I wouldn't say the wheels can't fall off, but we've made it pretty hard for it to fall off without us knowing about it. So we're able to quickly address it if it does get into a position where we're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah. Do you have any middle management yet, or is everyone reporting to you?
Still everybody to me, one way or the other. And I've been looking for someone to come in on the property management specifically. I had someone that I thought was going to be moved forward that it didn't end up happening, that I have been prepping to have this person basically take over what my role is like almost like a director of ops with it, and mm-hmm. be able to then step back and have them report to me. But yeah, in the current dynamic, it's still everybody rolling up to me.
Someone quits. Does it ruin your week?
No, I don't think it would ruin my week. The way that I've hired currently is we almost have too many overseas employees, so that in case that does happen, because I'm sure you're aware too, that like sometimes they just stop working. Like you can't really do much about it. And it might've come out of left field. So I've got like backups that are basically able to step in so that it wouldn't completely derail. But from that perspective, when I do have, and I have a good relationship with the company that sources these employees for me, so I can usually get people pretty quickly if I need to, because I have had what you just said happen. And the big thing I have is that once they do kind of potentially leave, the way that we built the Lead Simple software with us is that the next person that moves in, they just walk right into it and they're told exactly what to do and everything they need to do, because we've already built those training tutorials for each task that lives in the task So even if somebody new comes in, there's no confusion about thinking you're going to do it a different way, about not understanding it, because it's really crystal clear when they step into a role of what task they're going to be responsible for and what success looks like because they're watching a video of it being done.
With all, go ahead, Jack.
Does strategically, is property man? Do you guys consider property management a core business that you expect to be in 10 years from now for third parties, or is it something that you guys are doing because you want to afford this better system to manage your own properties? Or are they, you know, or is it like, hey, you know, as long as an owner is not blowing me up, you know, at 9 o'clock at night and making my life hell, like, yeah, we'll keep doing it.
Yeah. So it started out as just a means to an end to manage our properties more efficiently. But it's evolved into, we look at this as a core business now, because mm-hmm. I don't speak with the owners anymore. We have a salesperson that talks to the inbound ones that come in. We have a virtual assistant who is a client manager for owners. So the calls don't actually impact me and don't take away from what I'm able to do during the day. So yes, there are a lot of them. You know, the game of having third party owners who might have one house and an hour of your time every day to discuss that one house. And so we've evolved, because that was the case when our team is set up to be able to handle that. So I don't have to pull away from our more strategic stuff, and I can still kind of be marching without having to be too diverted. So yes, it has evolved to a core business.
In terms of maintenance on those properties, are you using the same same contractor that you've been referring to all along, or do you have additional staff of people for that?
We have additional staff. We have a maintenance team that works directly just for the property management company that handles any maintenance requests on the properties that we're managing, that do just our light turnovers. They do our repair calls, et cetera. And then we have a virtual assistant who is our maintenance coordinator, who is the one that coordinates all the communication through our property management portal to dispatch, to coordinate with tenants, to make sure that we're troubleshooting before we get to the point of actually sending a tech out that handles that backend process.
How do you find that labor? Because that labor is, I've my experience is that labor is increasingly, that labor reliably, like that finding those people who are reliable is increasingly difficult. And I mean, we're paying rates that I never thought we would be paying, but you know, people are making a good living doing maintenance work now.
Yeah. I mean, we've been lucky. So we've had the same people since we've never had anyone leave on the maintenance side. And I think it's, I don't want to, you know, echo what I said before about the construction, but they don't just feel like they're on an island doing some BS work. They see what the goal is. They're in here once a week for a meeting. I also, what I've done culture wise with our team members is we don't just do, you know, goal setting and so forth for the business. I take a personal interest in them, and we do goal setting for them outside of work. And we have conversations biweekly about where they're at with what they want to do outside of what they have in their own place of employment. We give them all, anybody in the company, and they can take 2 days off a week, an hour and a half early, or 1 day off a week, 3 hours off early, to be able to go do something if it's to better themselves. So if they were trying to lose weight and they want to go to the gym, if they want to spend more time with their kids and they have a swim meet, anything like that. So each employee, maintenance in their office, et cetera, even the virtual employees overseas, if they have something that's going to help them better themselves outside of just the workplace, because we are in such a hustle bustle kind of industry that sometimes you can lose focus on things outside of your day to day. We give them the opportunity to still know that that's important to us and that's important to them. And so what I think it does is it makes them be a better version of themselves. And then it gives us a better employee selfishly as well. But on top of that, it also lets them see something that they're not getting a lot of other places. So once they get involved in our culture, it almost feels like they want to be a part of it, because they're getting things that in a traditional property management company, they're not getting. And a lot of these guys have been in maintenance work, right? I mean, you don't just start being a maintenance tech. You usually work for a bigger organization, and then you get tired of the hours or the role or the pay, and then you look for something else. And being that we are still somewhat a small shop, I feel that that has really helped us grow. And then obviously then they have, usually a maintenance guy knows another maintenance guy. So then the referral game is important. And the same thing in construction is that once they see how they're treated and how they feel and the way that we are kind of pushing towards goals and handle them as a person, not just as an employee, they talk about it. And then you have people who want to come involved and be a part of that as well. So the labor, you know, it started, our first guy was the cousin of our property manager. And then he brought another guy in from his organization. He was at another, a big company around here, Jack, that wasn't happy there. The other one was a cousin of somebody on the construction company who didn't want to do like the upfront construction more, would rather do the maintenance that came in that worked from there. So we actually haven't even had to like quote unquote hire. Like we haven't had to put job postings up. We haven't had to put anything up to get those individuals in the right seats. And then they have been in a position where they've been able to help us across the board with pretty much anything maintenance related to the capacity that we need.
You mentioned the wheels fell off in another side of the business. What's that about?
Jack, you're reading my mind today.
Yeah. So the wheels did fall off in the holdings company side of the business and for a little bit. And we had to make a pivot. So originally, I think I alluded to this in the first episode, was we were buying homes in a lipstick on a pig type of fashion, right? So unfortunately, we were then refining those homes in that same time. And I just alluded to the fact that we got some of our homes in 30-year debt with 3.x interest. So when those turnovers are coming up and all of a sudden that like lipstick on a pig job has been exposed to what it is, and we need to put 15K into a turnover, where's that money coming from? Because we're not getting mm-hmm. the refi on the back end. And when you're mm-hmm. doing that with legacy properties, you know, 70, 80 strong, that's not a couple of dollars anymore. That's a significant amount of money that you're going to have to outlay that's not getting refied back afterwards, because you don't want to refi out of these 3% interest rates. And you also, there might not be as much meat on the bone to refi this time. So it's something that we didn't really recognize until we did a few of the turnovers and we're like, what is going on with our CapEx? Like it's crazy because you're not anticipating that. But then you look back to
we did the same thing.
I love when Jack gets that reminiscent look on his face, like, yeah, I've been there.
Yeah, we did the exact same thing. We were like, where is all the freaking money going? And we were just like turnovers were just murdering us.
Yeah.
And it was like all stuff that we hadn't done the first time. And it was like really deferred CapEx, but we didn't realize, you know, like we didn't spend all the money we should have the first time. And there was no free lunch. It was just the bills all come due.
Yep. And that's what happened. And so I identified the way that we were doing turnovers prior to the wheels falling off. So we had shifted course, but I didn't really look into what it was going to be when the ones that we didn't do correctly came due for being done correctly.
So we if we could just slow it down. So the initial, the way that you guys approached a rental rehab was, let's just get it in there. We'll get the thing operable, stick a tenant in it. It may not be as bulletproof as we'd like. And now you're realizing that, wait a minute here, when we go to set these rentals up, we need to rehab them in a way that there will be no CapEx in the future, right? Like, so, or at least for a while, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. So like in general, we were in the time 2017-18 where like we didn't have to do much and our refi, like our appraisals were high as anything. So we learned that. So we're like, okay, we can just quickly do this, get our higher refi or higher appraisal and then refi it. And then weren't thinking about if we're not changing and putting in a new water heater, even though the water heater looks like it needs to be done, that we're not anticipating now there's going to be, you know, X amount of charge in a year or 2 years, or, you know, we didn't replumb it or we didn't rewire it. And now, you know, we've got issues in all the pipes and now we need to just those things. So yes. And then to today and to where we started to shift, once I started to be more involved in the business from a you know, everyday perspective, was we do everything brand new. Every time the more beat up the house, the better for us, because we get a better buy on the front end, because we're going to do the same thing, whether it's like a decent house or it's a really crappy house. Like it doesn't matter, because we've gotten to a point now where we're spending the money up front. We're doing it correctly. We're able to underwrite it to us doing it correctly up front every time. And then we're able to capture the refi. But then at least if we're capturing the refi at this point in time, we know for the next X amount of time, we're not going to have these things because it's all brand new. And so then we've changed our philosophy pretty much entirely from where we started.
How does that knowledge and experience guide you when you go to sit down with a potential investor owner who wants to use your company as property management? Are you guys selective? You know, like if a guy wants to call up SMD and say, hey, we'd love for you to manage our portfolio, are you taking just anyone, or are you really examining the portfolio first to make sure that it's going to be one that you can successfully manage?
We have a pretty candid conversation with them where even if they haven't been doing it, we let them know what we have. We don't hide the fact that we made mistakes in the beginning and that we were in a tough spot and we had to figure out ways to get out of it because of the fact that we were maybe not aware enough that that is something we need to be paying attention to. Mm-hmm. So we have candid conversations. If they historically haven't done it, we're not going to say no. If they have an open mind to moving forward, that if they're adding more properties, it's done in the correct way. And then obviously if they hadn't historically done it, we're there to do it for them when they are ready for them to change over the course of what they're doing. So yeah, we will not manage for slumlords. Like we won't. It goes like if my granddad came to me today, he's not around anymore. If he came to me, he'd be like, "Hey man, I love you, but it ain't happening, bud." So like
the original lessons from Pop Pop.
Yeah. He taught me a lot. So it's one of those things where, you know, we don't manage for slumlords. We will not manage any property that, you know, like you said, the owner's not committed to how to be a good rental owner. And if they've made mistakes in the past, but they're willing to change course, we're all about helping people get back on track. But we're not going to sit there and continue to be along for the ride when they go down the tubes.
So where'd the cash come from, though? Because that's a lot of cash.
Yeah, so we had to self-fund a decent amount, and then when that got to a point where we couldn't do it, we took in an outside partner. Basically, we went to somebody who we knew was looking to get into the space, and we sold some equity into the existing portfolio. Not anything new down the line, but the existing portfolio we had, we sold a chunk of it percentage-wise so that we were able to recuperate that with the info that came in. So I'd said originally, I think the first episode, we never took outside money. We had to take it. And so from us owning everything without having any investor be involved and everything is ours, that changed. And going forward, he's not involved in anything going forward because we are doing historically correct. But we're moving forward in the right direction, even though we didn't do it historically correct. But anything in the past, he's now part owner in that had to we had to give up that own everything ourselves.
So I have this theory that I'm sure it's right, but no one talks about it. That there's a lot of guys who bought all over the country, who built rental portfolios very quickly, 1920, particularly 2021, early part of 2022, right? Because DSCR rates were incredibly low. Every rental property made sense. And so it was very easy to like, just if you're a hustler, like it was very easy to just, if you were good at acquisitions, that's all you needed, right? Like just be good at acquisitions. The refi took care of itself and like, just pay a GC to do whatever, right? Just get it rent ready and then put somebody in there. Like tenants, you know, needed places to live, like everything rented immediately, right? Like nothing was on the rental list and the refi was really fast. So like those aspects of operations were easy. And so if you're an acquisitions guy, you're just building a rental portfolio super fast. You were able to. And I saw all of a sudden like all these young guys like just, you know, going from 0 to 100 units in like 2 years. And I'm like, dude, I'm horrified. I'm mortified because I'm like, I know they don't have any other income. And I know that those turnovers are going to murder them. Yep. And I'm like, you know, if you get like 3-4 years of tenancy duration in a decent situation, like it's starting to happen, like it's gonna start to happen this year. And next year is gonna be freaking rough as like they get these like $15,000, $20,000 turnovers. That they didn't budget for, right? Because they took out 75% LTV. They used the excess proceeds above their cost basis to go buy more houses. And they didn't do the renovation right the first round. And I'm really, I think that there's like going to be a bunch of like shakeout over the course of the next couple of years as that exact issue that you just talked about, which exactly happened to us and put us in a cash flow freaking crunch. It happened to us 10 years ago, but it was a problem. It was a problem 10 years ago. And it's going to happen to these guys who like built really quickly and don't have other sources of income to pay those bills as they start to come due. Cause you don't see turnover costs until, you know, 3-4 years after you buy the first house, right? Like it's a delayed thing from a cash flow management point of view. I just think that there's a chicken that's going to come home to roost like all over the place, and there's going to be a bunch, and maybe they just, the unit gets turned over and they just flip it, right? Cause like, hopefully they bought it well enough that they can just sell some equity, but they're either going to be bringing in equity investors like you're talking about to help manage cash flow, or they're going to be forced to liquidate. But I feel like that's a common experience that we've heard from, you know, guys building portfolios, that, you know, that realization is a painful one and not an intuitive one necessarily, right? Like seems fine, but
yeah.
Hey, Sean, anyway, we have just a few minutes left with you and can't thank you enough for your time. Give us sort of the horizon. What's on the horizon for you guys? What are the goals over the next few years and you know, what appears to be sort of a challenging economic time right now? And, you know, tell us where you guys are going.
Yeah, I can't thank you enough for letting me be on the podcast. And I think the big thing for me is that we're going to continue to buy. Depending on what we do with them after we buy, that's what's going to change with the climate of the industry is, but we're buying. I've been bullish, and as you can tell from as young as five years old, I want to own real estate. And that's been my goal setting into these different businesses, is that the overarching goal is to buy houses to add to a portfolio for that next level generational wealth for my kids and for my family. So we're going to continue to buy. We've been buying, 6-7 a month over the last few months. We are going to continue to be opportunistic with what we do with those. So we're flipping, we're wholesaling, we're wholetailing. We're not going to just be head down, buy, portfolio, which we have been for historically since we've been started doing this. Mm-hmm. We're not putting our foot off the gas with how we go forward. And we're just going to be creative with what we need to do to make sure that the machine keeps getting fed to be able to continue to grow. We've really made a big focus historically on holding properties. We brought in this director of construction recently to help us with managing the prospects of the different jobs, the third party, the internal jobs, and then obviously what we're doing with the process. We've also brought in a CFO to help us with deciding what the right move is, whether we're going to flip it, whether we're going to wholetail it, whether we're going to do a hold based on where our cash flow is at, because we are realizing this is a different time, like we've been chatting about. So, if we got a couple of projects out right now and we've extended ourselves and then there's a really good opportunity, but we need some cash flow before historically we were kind of doing that stuff on the fly, where now we have somebody in a position that's all they're doing is making sure that we're on track with what we have out compared to what we have coming in to make sure there's no overlaps. We're going to continue to grow the different businesses. We've had some new ones that really didn't go into the staging design one, but that one's really been ramping up recently and having a lot of success with that. And we're going to continue to look for opportunities where we can to try to continue to develop this Baltimore C-class neighborhood, kind of a landscape that's out here.
Jack, as I've watched you and Fred over the years, and we've talked so much about the word pivot over the last several episodes, it's always been apparent to me that, you know, amongst all the businesses that you and Fred have, you guys were always able to pivot within those businesses to, you know, create income, create equity during, you know, the last 15 or so years. And Sean, your story is so similar, really, and strikingly similar, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy because I honestly, I met Fred and Jack at IMN. I was in a room and I think Fred said something to the effect of, like, he said something, somebody called him Mr. Baltimore. At this point, this was, I don't remember what year it was, but I was like just starting out. I'm like, who's this guy, Mr. Baltimore? And so, like, chatted with him, met Jack, and then, you know, with what we were doing, I always looked at, like, I was trying to progress into a role to be in line with how they had built their businesses, because I saw what it had given both of them from a top end as far as what they owned, what they had involvement in, and how they'd grown their portfolios and so forth. So it's definitely something that, from a top line perspective is very aligned with where we want to go, is where they are at and where they're continuing to go. So it's definitely something that has been, a fun ride to be on, and to have Jack and Fred to be able to tap into sometimes when I'm in a position where I'm like, man, I don't know what's going on. They're like, oh yeah, we do. Like, we know exactly what's going on. We know where you've been at, and, we know how we can try to help you get through it. So, been a part of the RIR group there, which is the mastermind. And that's been a huge benefit to not just having Jack and Fred to be able to tap into, but also the other investors in that room from other places throughout the country. So, anybody that's not involved in a mastermind, definitely look into it, because it really takes you outside of your day to day and gets you outside and get some perspective from not just your market, but other people doing different things and where things are going. So, it's been a lot of help from them, and really appreciate it, and having the opportunity to chat here on the podcast today.
We had the mastermind in town last week, Jack, and I have to say, if there's any more folks coming in, you better get a bigger room, because the place was packed.
Yeah, no, it's been really great. We've got we're getting about 30 folks who are showing up on every 4 months, and everyone's like you know, really, really strong operators, like usually have at least 100 units, at least doing 50 deals a year, combination of different business models. Some folks doing like small commercial, a lot of resi is like a consistent theme throughout the entire room. But I really enjoy those meetings because the conversation is super high level. You're able to compare notes with folks across business models, across markets. So you can get a sense of like, you know, is it just me? Like, is this just my pain, or is this being shared? And what are other folks' sentiment? So it's been a really great group, and was thrilled to have Sean join us a couple years ago. By the way, if anyone who's interested in that, we're always recruiting. We're trying to keep it a pretty small group, but we usually invite 3 or 4 new folks each time to present and get a sense of them, and frankly see if we think they're a good fit. So if anyone's interested in that, we're actually going to be recruiting at the IMN single family conferences in Miami in May, and then in Scottsdale in December. We've resolved that we're going to have a booth at that conference because we find there's a lot of high level operators that go to that conference. But for anyone who's interested in that group, just shoot me an email. It's jack@thedominiongroup.com. And you just, you know, let me know that you're interested and we'll hop on a call. Yeah, Sean, really appreciate you having on the call today. I mean, the challenges are the same, the works are the same, and it's a lot of both, growing a single family portfolio, and just been really impressed, obviously, with you and Mike and Dave and the platform that you guys have built. And I think, you know, really, that's really the approach, right, is that you're actually building a platform, not just executing a thing that you saw work and then just doing it over and over until you hit a brick wall. So, you know, really impressed with you guys as operators and friends. And so thanks for joining us today. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Sean, I can think of any number of people that might be listening to this podcast who would want to reach out in terms of, you know, property management or any number of things. Why don't you go ahead and tell folks how they can get in touch?
Yeah, so we have a direct link on our website that shows you a little bit about us and our property management business, as well as our overarching theme of what we do at www.smdcapitalgroup.com. And that's Sean Michael David, capitalgroup.com. And then we also have our construction business is Exclusive Home Group. You can reach out there, www.exclusivehomegroup.com. As well as on Instagram, we have SMD Management, SMD Capital, and Exclusive Home Group with their own Instagram handles, just as you are there.
Great conversation. Can't thank you enough for taking an entire morning to spend with Jack and I. Really look forward to meeting you in person one day, and continued success, my friend. You are one busy man. So yeah. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks a lot, guys. Really appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, Sean.
Hope you enjoyed this episode and the last episode with Sean. Tune in next time. This is Craig Feuer and Jack Bevere with Real Investor Radio. We'll see you next time.